Mathematics, because you had a major in a science, or mathematics is one subset of what is a science. And Jimmy specialized in mathematics and became a mathematician. And Jimmy went on to Stanford and got his master's degree. And while he took a few courses, he never bothered to get a doctorate degree. He didn't need it in his work. And he worked with IBM for 5 years and got a gold medal from them for his contribution on optimizing their telephone system, and then he went out and optimized telephone systems for a number of other companies.
This is
still doing
the James you're talking about.
The middle boy. The oldest son went to NYU in Princeton, got his doctorate degree and PhD in political science, taught for 10 years at American University in Washington, D.C., the last three of which he went to law school and became a lawyer. Now he's a lawyer with the National Labor Board in Washington. His wife's a psychiatrist.
Do they have a family?
They have two girls. The oldest girl is 19 this year, and the next girl is 17. They've both been bat mitzvahed. The oldest girl is finishing her 1 year between high school and college in a kibbutz in Israel on the Habonim Dror work study group. And she'll be back in time for our first 50th anniversary affair in the end of August, when we get the family together in the Greenbrier, Sulphur Springs, West Virginia. Our third son, Eddie, went to Pitt.
Excuse me for interrupting you a minute. Where is James living?
He lives in Scarsdale, New York.
And he is married?
Yeah, he has two girls. The girls are 15 and 12. The youngest one is going to be, she'll be 13, my goodness. She's going to be bat mitzvah in May 24th. Time goes by.
It really does. Now we'll come to Eddie.
And his and Jimmy's wife's a teacher.
I see.
And remedial reading is one of her specialties. And then Eddie went to Pitt, and when he graduated, he married a Pitt schoolmate, Sarah Crystal. And he went to Hebrew College, was ordained in 1972 as a rabbi, and ran a congregation in Cincinnati while he was doing his doctorate work. And he got a PhD there, not one of these honorary things, a PhD in Hebrew literature. Then he had a congregation of 500 members in the conservative movement, although he was ordained Reform, in Nashville, Tennessee. It's a congregation that Arthur Hertzberg had. He was a young man. But after a couple of years there, he decided he didn't want to be a pulpit rabbi. And then in 1980, he joined the company and worked in our, cut his eye teeth selling in our locker division, and is now an assistant to me in executive management.
I see. So he left the rabbinate.
Yeah, but he's Orthodox, belongs to the Young People's Synagogue.
I see.
And so...
And he is married, is he?
Yes, he has three boys. The boys are 15, 14 and 12 and a half and 9. They all go to Hillel School.
They're living here in the city.
Yeah, they all go to Hillel School, and they're Hebrew students, and they're Orthodox.
And your daughter, Ellen.
Ellie went to Brandeis and married one of her schoolmates, who became a doctor and then a radiologist. And she went to Columbia and got her master's degree in social work and worked for a couple years at Roosevelt Hospital in New York City as a medical social worker while her husband was doing his residency, and then decided she didn't want to be a social worker. She got too involved personally. She didn't want to be a medical social worker. And so she became an accountant. She studied, went back to school in Harrisburg, got an accounting degree, then got a computer. Operations certificate, it's not a degree, and computer programmer and operator. And she has three children. The oldest girl is 11, and the boy is 8 and a half, and the baby is 3 years old, girl.
to contrast the way you were raised with the way your children were raised in terms of permissiveness, advantages, nobility, whatever.
Of course, they lived in, they were all born during and grew up in the course of the growing Jewish Renaissance in this great large Christian country, which is the United States of America. And that's an entirely different world from one in which I grew up. Because I was raised in a coal mining town down in Greene County, Nemeco, Pennsylvania. And my father had a general merchandise store, so when I was 10, 11, 12 years old, while I worked in the store, learned all about business and customers and so on. It's a different world from what my children brought up. And rightly so. Got to be progress from one generation to the next, or it isn't progress.
Well, it's good that you view it as progress.
Yeah. Well, progress, change. Yeah, I'm sure it's progress because you can do so much more. Our third son, Eddie, who's in the company with me, he's a computer bug. Of course, our middle son, Jim, he works a big computer in New York, and his practice, well, he has a $5,000 to $6,000 a month bill just for the rental of a huge computer that he needs for his work. And our oldest son, Charlie, he hasn't gone for computers, but he's good in mathematics. And then, of course, our daughter. So three of the four are computers. And Eddie, the Orthodox son who's in the company with me, he has two computers at home and he has one in the office, and has installed a CAD/CAM system in our Rollform division and a commercial IBM system there. And the boys, they do their schoolwork on the computers at home, and the little nine-year-old, why, he has a paper to do while he does it on the computer.
Well, as you say, they grew up in a different world.
That's right. So I think that's I would call it progress.
Do they share your interest in art and in Israel?
Well, the only one that they all have an interest in Israel. They've all been processed through Israel. Our daughter Ellie went for the better part of a year to the Leo Beck School in Haifa when she was a junior at Ellis School. All three of the boys have been processed through Israel, spending summer there, and they visit fairly often. And Eddie just left on Sunday with his middle son, the one that's going to be bar mitzvah now in November. He left for 2 weeks on yesterday for Israel.
Are they going to be bar mitzvah in Israel?
No, here. The bar mitzvah won't be till November for Havre. That's his bar mitzvah gift. So
I see. Mr. Rudenberg, would you contrast Pittsburgh today with Pittsburgh yesterday as regard to social, cultural, and political factors?
I think Fifth Avenue, which was the Jewish wholesale merchant area with the delicatessen stores, that's from 6th Avenue coming back about 10 streets. And as a boy, I used to come with my father. He bought merchandise for his store there. And they served a great purpose. That was before the chain stores, before Zayers and Montgomery Ward and Sears grew up into stores. And all of those discount stores, which changed the method of distribution, so those wholesalers are no longer in existence. Their function was usurped by the chain stores, which do their own centralized buying straight from factories. So there's hardly any wholesaling going on there. But what is going on there? Their sons and daughters and grandsons and granddaughters are taking over those old buildings and revitalizing them. And you take Harold Gondelman. He's taken a nice building, an old building down there, right into a lovely building, which is his law offices. And he's a prominent lawyer. And there are doctors that invested in the rehabilitation of those houses. I think those old stores that were there some of them 4 or 5 stories high because they had warehouses upstairs. That symbolizes the change.
What about the social awareness in terms of the social agencies filling the gap, meeting needs? Do you see more of a social awareness than in past years?
Well, of course, my father's generation, the immigrant generation, they didn't have time much to get involved in doing much more than making a living and providing for their families. They didn't have the free time or motivation for that. In my generation, we were predominantly activists in social action programs. And of course, my own case, I spent a dozen years of my life as a labor union factotum.
Would you say culturally Pittsburgh has expanded in terms of symphony, art, and so on?
Yeah, it's interesting. You had Carnegie that gave the facilities for the Carnegie Library. He put libraries all around the area.
Yes.
He likewise endowed the Carnegie Tech, which is now Carnegie Mellon University, in order to train metallurgists, mechanical, and electrical engineers for the steel industry. That was what it was. It wasn't until 1935, 36, 37 that they brought in social sciences to Carnegie Tech. And I remember in my early union days, there were some professors that come in there, and we used to meet with them. They'd invite us to come and give speeches, but up until then, it was all technical courses. It was just a great big vocational school, and that's all it was. It never was an MIT, in the sense that MIT started from a different motivation. Of course, he got the music hall, and he provided funds for Victor Herbert, who was a conductor here, 1900 to 1904, sometime in that period. And all through my years going to Pitt, we got to hear Paderewski and Rachmaninoff and Heifetz Fritz Kreisler, Yasha Heifetz, Piatigorsky at the Syria Mosque.
Also at the Y.
The Y series, yeah. We heard Mimi Lerner yesterday. Mimi Lerner is a younger person than mine, of course, and very talented. Crowan, who likes to crow against everybody, has a very favorable review of her concert.
I saw that. Some people call him Groan.
Yes, he sits right in front of us at the symphony Friday nights.
Do you think the city has changed politically?
Well, it's in the process of changing. It's been a Democratic political party city, and it's had the blacks have been antagonized by the Republicans, so that they're predominantly Democratic Party people. But now you have the impoverishment of the blue-collar workers who are making 40, 50, 60,000 a year. Family income is up as high as 100,000 a year. Great personal tragedies that the jobs are gone or they're not all working. Then you have the creation of offices and services here, and the development of technical.
Well, let's come to the economic changes in Pittsburgh, Mr. Rutenberg. Back in 1964, in your publication, How to Save and Create Jobs in the Pittsburgh Area, you saw the handwriting on the wall, so to speak, and actually predicted what has come to pass in the economic life of our city. In your view, do both unions and management bear some responsibility?
Oh, I'm just thinking about it. I've been asked to give an interview on the 50th anniversary of the founding of the Steelworkers Union, which was June 17, 1936. So the 50th year comes up, and I agreed to interview, and I would say that the responsibility for the demise of the steel industry, about 20% is the union, and about 40% the financiers, the market, and about That's 60, and about 30% would be management, and about 10% would be world affairs. I mean, the union's responsibility, we tried in my days, we tried, and during the war we were able to, we tried to develop a program of union management cooperation, increased productivity, because otherwise the combined economic political power of the union was so great that it could bankrupt the companies because they could extract more money from them than they could afford to pay over a period of time. But that's only about a 20% factor. The biggest single factor is when Jim Link bought Jones and Laughlin steel for $86 a share, then you had a complete change in the policy of steel companies. Up to that time, the steel companies were run as steel companies to make steel. But then he introduced a change that they were no longer in the steel business, they were in the money-making business. They're in business to make money. Steel was just their vehicle. So many of them were looking for other vehicles like U.S. Steel to make money, become money-making machines. That was one of the larger nails in the coffin. Thirdly, management, for short-term reasons, and they're judged on the annual P&L statement, they went and sold and helped all kind of countries around the world to create steel facilities. And while they were doing it, they knew over the long run why it's potentially competition, but yet it helped them. They helped them with their P&L statement for that year, and they looked at it from short term. And then I'd give about 10% factor to the world economy as a whole, which deals with political foreign exchange rates and so forth. The union is responsible in a way that they don't comprehend and won't admit, and that is that they didn't realize that by extracting more from management than the management get the company to produce to pay, they discouraged capital investment. They won't admit it, and they don't appreciate it, but they did, case after case. They just U.S. Steel was going to spend $4 billion to create a new, big, modern steel mill up at Ashtabula on the lake. But after the Lincoln-Jones-Laughlin affair, the business center making money, not just making steel, they had all the work practices. My God, to run a steel company today, you have to run it according to a whole big library of arbitration decisions that are there, and those work practices have been transferred to the big plant at Ashtabula. Spear was the last real steel man we had. He died of cancer, and after him, there never was a head of U.S. Steel dedicated to that project, and they abandoned it. They may still own that land up there. I don't know where they had it.
In this morning's Post-Gazette, on the editorial page, they stated the labor agreement just completed between negotiators for LTV Steel Company and the United Steelworkers Union suggests that both management and labor this year are wisely conscious of each other's problems.
Well, it's a nice generality, but you see, the union is unable to practice the kind of union management cooperation it takes to do the job. They don't know how to cooperate because the union's job, as they visualized it, was to protect jobs, to provide work. When the big argument that I had led to my leaving the union had to do with a case out of the TC&I, Tennessee Coal and Iron Division of U.S. Steel, in Alabama, where you had a crew, I forget the exact number on the crew, but they were paid a group incentive. And whenever it was possible to do that crew's work with two fewer people, the company was perfectly willing to pay the incentive to everybody, not to reduce their incentive. They'd get the benefit of those two that are eliminated, but no, they wouldn't stand for the elimination of those two jobs. They were in the business of protecting jobs. They don't realize, and even to this day, they don't comprehend the role of the company. The company is the job provider. And here's Wabco. and not WAPCO. Union Switch and Signal, that's owned by WAPCO, isn't it? Yeah. Union Switch and Signal. They have a 6-month strike, and they get surprised because the company, during that 6 months, the board of directors and the top people said, boy, we've had a belly full of this, and as soon as we can, we're going to get the hell out of these facilities, and they now are moving to other plants. And now they're going to try to get them to save their jobs, you know, but still, in their whole concept of saving jobs, they don't know, they don't comprehend that it's the employer who is the job provider. And he isn't providing jobs because he loves them. He's providing jobs because he needs them to achieve his objective.
But you still only give labor 20% of the responsibility.
They're the, I hate to say this in the time of the women's movement, but they're the female end of the relationship. The management which covers both management, the financiers, and then that 40% I give the financiers and the management, the 20%, 30% just management. World affairs, I just give 10%. They're trying to give 100% to the imports. So.
Well, what do you see for Pittsburgh's economic future then?
Well, back in 1900, early turn of the century, there was a big landslide over the Pennsylvania Railroad, where near the Pennsylvania Railroad Station is. There was, when it was the Pennsylvania Railroad Station, the building's still there. And the city had a big controversy about paying a $5,000 fee to the consultant who was brought in and asked what to do about it. And he came and examined the slide, and he says, let it slide. There's anything you can do. There's nothing you can do. It's just a great, horrible tragedy for all these individuals. You had to go, it's just a repetition of what happened in the cotton fields and textile fields up in New England at the turn of the century, and they moved down south. I mean, these jobs have moved to Korea and Japan and elsewhere, plus the fact that the utilization of steel is being eliminated in many, many places. I mean, tin cans, we won't be using tin cans much longer for canned foods. They're becoming in cardboard packages with aluminum foil lining. You already can get things in the store on that on a trial basis. But that come, the bumpers of automobiles are being made out of plastic increasingly. The fenders and body is going to be made out of plastic. By 1990-1991 cars are fairly in. The Fiero car of General Motors, the Corvette are plastic bodies. The cabs of almost all of our big trucks are fiberglass, plastic, because for every 1,000 pounds you can save on the weight of the truck, you can haul another 1,000 pounds with that tractor. So that the use of steel has just greatly declined. The shrinkage of the size of the automobiles have cut the steel market right there. They cut them out of 10 or 15% of their market. So the market shrinks, and those are all factors that have nothing to do with foreign competition, nothing to do with running a steel company to make money, not to make steel primarily. It has to do with changing circumstances, and I don't put that in there as a factor. I guess in dividing up the factors by 100%, I should cut that 40% from the finances down to 30 and put 10% in there for declining utilization of steel.
I see. Well, how do we go about expanding new sources of employment here? Are we going to become...
Well, it's the most amazing thing, because I know my brother's an economist, and I was and still am in a way, but not a practicing one. And I know a number of years ago, 15 or so years ago, we were talking about how the additions to the workforce, a million and a quarter, 1.5 million a year, where are you going to find jobs for all these people? At that time, I think maybe there were 85 million gainfully employed. Well, there's 108 million gainfully employed people today in this country. 108 million. It's just unbelievable to me, absolutely unbelievable. When Reagan took power, I think it was around 100 million. It's going to be 8 million. Now, where are they? Well, they're making hot dogs and serving Wendy's and doing all kinds of services. In our office today, we had the Purolator man came, the Federal Express man. We had a package to go Federal Express. And he also delivered one. Well, another guy did it, and they're service guys. My office is here in Oakland. I have something to send downtown. I call the courier service. So a guy comes in a courier. He shows up. He fixes it up. He takes it down. It's lower paying, a reduction in standard of living. I remember I had a professor who said that an individual who was making, in those days, $30,000 was a lot of money, who was making $30,000, he lost his job, he had to take a job for $12,000, that was a personal tragedy, but he was not a social case. Well, those who are displaced from high-paying, high-income jobs to lower ones, it may be personal tragedy, they're not social cases, except those who can't get jobs, they then become social cases.
Would you see us then becoming more research or service-oriented here?
Well,
there's tremendous amount of office space being built.
Yes, but the... We don't have such a tremendous vacancy on office space. We have enough office space available and under construction to last us for another 5 or 10 years. But our total office space in this city is a little under 440 million square feet. And the man that I heard give a speech at Duquesne Cup, he was from one of the big real estate companies, says that in Houston, the total idle, empty square footage in offices is 40 million square feet. So it gives you some proportion on it. And of our 38 or 39 million square feet, I think it's about 10 or 12% that's unused. What happens is that people upgrade, they move up. I mean, the Oliver building has Allegheny Ludlum move out. And who comes up? People come out of the Empire building, they come out of this place on the Boulevard of the Allies. They move up, you know, and they move, and the rents aren't as high, but on the other hand, they're older buildings, their mortgages are paid, the depreciation is down, and so you have those continuous dynamic changes. And wealth is only created by adding value, and you have to have value-added enterprises. It can't all be bankers and hamburger service individuals. But here you take Manhattan, you know, the biggest industry in Manhattan? What is the biggest industry in Manhattan? Biggest employer? Shipping. It's a big port. And the shipping and all jobs related to shipping is the biggest single employer in New York City. It's the biggest, one of the biggest employers in Baltimore. Philadelphia, they're not quite the ports that used to be. Savannah, Georgia, I think a majority of its population are directly and indirectly related to shipping. Savannah.
Do you have any guess as to what new industries will come here? Or what will it be, a research center? What will take the place of what we've lost?
Well, here, you take the Gulf is gobbled up by Chevron, Standard Oil, California. And here's a research grab, and I just saw where General Motors needed some research work done right away. And so they've taken over a couple of the buildings out here, and they're funding the lab, and they're paying money to the school. And so they have a research center there, and they'll be employing Gulf at its peak, I think, had a couple thousand people out there. And I think that that's just one. The need is there, and the facility is there. I know that with the workforce that exists, and I got to be careful how to say this publicly, but the workforce that exists here, I would not create a labor-intensive factory in Pittsburgh area because they don't appreciate the job provider function. They just take it for granted. And if you... And that no matter what, there's nothing they can do that can discourage you from continuing to provide them with a job. Well, there is things they can do that can discourage you. And in my case, it discouraged me. I wouldn't attempt. I attended a meeting of Cal Jerry when he first became mayor, and they never invited me again to that. I says, that was a time, I know when it was a time of the impeachment of Nixon, because I says, any officer of any of these companies headquartered here that created a factory here, he'd be impeached. And since then, there hasn't been a single one of them that created a factory here. None of the headquarter companies created a new business here, a new factory here. None of them. there are any of them, tell me who they are. Joe Katz, he went and built a big factory, moved over from Center Avenue, moved out to this O'Hara Township or someplace, built a big factory, biggest mistake he ever made. And he knows it, and he says so. And so most of the paper craft employment, I would doubt if 10% work out of there at that factory. I doubt, I think 90% must be elsewhere.
Are you saying it's because it's heavily unionized in this area?
I'd be glad just to the unions. It could be without a union, too. It's just the supper table philosophy. I discussed that in the book, which doesn't necessarily have to be union. But the union always gets the blame. The union adopts the supper table philosophy, which is best exemplified by a British movie I saw where a worker